Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 9th. Today's session is entitled Masks, Mystery, and Magic, presented by Zarco Guerrero, number GUZ-2003-02. Let's listen in.
I think unique, especially when you consider that I make masks for a living. I use masks, I perform with masks. And I don't think probably met too many mask makers that live exclusively off the mask. However, I do sculpture as well. I was trained initially as a portrait painter. My father was a portrait artist. So I grew up around my father painting portraits. But maybe you've seen my son. He's seen him in the V's around the arc sometimes. He's also a portrait artist. So he's kind of taken on the tradition as well. But as I was a young kid growing up, kind of like these guys, I used to watch my father paint portraits. And it was usually of kids from the neighborhood. We grew up in his studio was in a Mexican neighborhood, kind of on the outskirts of our town. A number of the people there were of Yaqui descent. So Yaquis are the Indian peoples from northern Mexico that fled the Mexican army and found refuge in the U.S. sort of about the same time that the Apaches fled into Mexico, running away from the American cavalry. You know, the Yaquis went this way. They had the Indian peoples, you know, scrambling all over the place to try to find sanctuary somewhere. So my father would get the kids and sit them down and start drawing their portraits, and I would watch how he would take a blank piece of paper and with a piece of charcoal, just start making lines and shading. And before you know it, somehow he would capture the likeness of that person, the essence of that person, the soul of that person. Sometimes he didn't. And when he didn't, it was a very frustrating experience for him. But when he did, almost simultaneously, he and I would become elated. And so that was like, I think for me as a young man, a magical, mystical moment. And I wanted that magic. I wanted that power that he had. I mean, it just seemed like the ultimate experience to be able to capture somebody's soul, so to speak. A term that I discovered later. Indian peoples often shy away from the camera. They don't want to be photographed because they're afraid that the photograph is going to capture their soul. And that's exactly what it looked like to me, capturing the essence of that person, the personality, the character. So I started drawing like crazy, and in school I became obsessed with drawing, and that's what my friends encouraged me to do. You know, draw me this, draw me that, draw, draw, draw. So I drew constantly, constantly. And of course, what happened? The more I drew, what happened? Do you know? The more you practice, what happens?
The better you get.
The better you get, that's right. And so as soon as I was able, my father would take me to, he taught a class in portraiture, and I started painting portraits as well, painting portraits in oil. And so I grew up in Mesa, Arizona. It's a Mormon community. It's the largest Mormon enclave outside of Salt Lake City. The Mormon presence is very, very dominant. And I went to a Catholic school right down the street, even though neither of my parents were practicing Catholics. I guess it was just kind of convenient that school was so close, we went to Catholic school. But I became, as a young man, very captivated, enthralled, inspired with the Mass and became an altar boy, almost obsessed with being part of the service. Sometimes I'd serve Mass three or four times a day on a Sunday, and every day during the week, it was another obsession with me to participate. But my father was very skeptical about religion, especially Catholicism. And he would take me as much as possible around the Phoenix area to Indian ceremonies and rituals, because he wanted me to be aware of the fact that we were of Indian heritage, because we were so far removed. And there were, outside of Phoenix, there's a village called Guadalupe, Arizona. that is a Yaqui village. At that time, it was a village, and it was difficult to get to because it was really out, way outside of town, in the middle of the desert. At one time, the Yaquis were lower in the valley where they got irrigation and they planted crops and they did well. But the more and more people that came in, they actually moved them off the nice piece of land that they had and perched them on top of a hill in Guadalupe where there was no water. You know, so that really impoverished the Indian people, but they persevered. And every Easter, they would have their Easter ceremonies. That was a fascinating combination of traditional Yaqui, pagan, if you will, ritual and ceremony blended with Catholic ceremony. And in this ceremony, they had a rich pageantry of masks, where they used masks. A society of the Yaquis called the False Faces would make masks of the Pharisees. And the more horrible the mask, the better. And they would make them out of leather across the face, and then make noses out of wood and ears out of leather, and paint them and put in teeth and fur from different animals, from javelina, from, you know, whatever animals they could find. So they're really grotesque masks that depicted the Pharisees. And Easter time in Arizona, it's hot. It's already getting to be summertime, in the 90s, even into the 100s. And they dress themselves in black clothing and wrap themselves in blankets. So to be as uncomfortable as possible. And then they dance during the day and into the night. During the day, it's really hot. And then at night, it still gets very, very cold. And the thing I really remember was the dust from hundreds of people dancing and stirring up the dust and just dancing for hours. It's not quite a dance. It's kind of like a march, just back and forth and back and forth. So that's one of the dances that takes place all night long. The next day, they take the masks and a big bonfire, and they burn the masks. They purge the mask of the evil that the Pharisees represent. So that's one of the things that takes place during the Easter ceremonies. The other thing that takes place is the deer dance. You might have seen this. It's where a man wears the deer on his head, and he's hunted by a hunter with a bow. And you see this man with a deer head imitating the deer. But that was another magical moment that I remember as a child, how this man could transform into a deer. You see the man, but he becomes the deer. And it was the most amazing thing I had ever seen in my life, you know. Especially when I would see deer afterwards, and I would recall the deer dance. Even now when I see the deer out here, the way they move, you know, their gestures and everything. It was just phenomenal to me. And my father wanted me to acknowledge and recognize that we were of Yaqui heritage. Didn't want me to use that. Well, growing up as a kid, I just took it for granted. I never really placed much value on that. And I wanted to be an artist. And to me at that time, to be an artist was to imitate European art. All the great art was from Europe. I got that idea because every book that I looked into, every book that I saw was European art, right? The art of the Renaissance, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, the modern artist, Picasso, Gauguin. They were all of European descent. And so I devoured the books. I read the lives of the artists, and I wanted to, you know, be a sculptor like Michelangelo, wanted to be an artist like Da Vinci. So my goal at that time was to go to Europe and to study art in Europe and to see the great art of Europe. So as soon as I got out of high school, I just took off. I went to Europe and I did exactly that. And while in Europe, while I was seeing all this great art, I got turned on to modern art and started discovering the art of Henry Moore, Picasso, Matisse, Calder, all these artists. And I started to realize that these European artists that I wanted to emulate were inspired by tribal art, by indigenous art. They started seeing Japanese prints coming from Japan. They started seeing pre-Columbian art from Mexico. They started seeing masks from Africa. And when they saw this new form of art for them, they became fascinated and inspired. They took this vitality that they found in this tribal art and put it into their artwork that they felt European tradition was stagnant and boring and mundane. And so they fused the two together and they created modern art. So that all of a sudden, I was in Europe and I was forced to look back to my own heritage for inspiration, for style. And I said, wow, these great artists were inspired by my homeland, by my people, by my heritage that I don't know really anything about. So I decided at that point that I wanted to come back to the Southwest. I wanted to rediscover my roots, so to speak. My father, as well as being a portrait artist, was a surface archaeologist. So he would take long treks into the desert and just walk around and find shards of pottery, arrowheads, beads, bracelets, pieces of necklaces, pieces of earrings. And the house was full of all this ancient loot that he found. And so I all of a sudden I came back and I started going through all his things and started finding all these treasures. And was realized how much beauty and how much ancient history was right around the area where we live. And so it was about that time that was during the early 70s that the farm workers movement led by Cesar Chavez was going on full blast. And I kind of got involved in that movement at the time because people were looking for young artists to illustrate this movement. And what happened was artists like myself started painting murals in the inner city that were an alternative to the mainstream media that we had been used to seeing. You know, all we saw ourselves as Mexicans or indigenous people depicted as gangsters, as prostitutes, as gardeners, as inmates. And so what we wanted to was to exalt our Indian heritage, find pride in it, and also to align ourselves with Cesar Chavez and his struggle for social justice and for equality. And so the muralists started exploring the art of ancient Mexico, the Aztec, the Maya, and started to not only look at visually the imagery, but also to discover the philosophy of our ancestors, and to find out the value of those teachings of our ancestors that we never learned about. You know, basically, what we learned growing up was that our Indian heritage was useless. You know, it was that Indian peoples no longer had any value or even existed. I mean, you know, I grew up thinking that the Aztecs of Mexico and the Maya had long since disappeared. You know, I found out later that wasn't the case. But through Cesar Chavez, we became aware of this idea of social justice and equality. And all of a sudden, we had a pride in who we are. We had a positive role model. Before, there had never been, you know, someone who was like ourselves, who was a Mexican-American, who was eloquent, who was spiritual, and who was a leader, a strong, compassionate leader, who did what no man had ever done. They said nobody could organize the farm workers, the poorest people in America. And he did. He organized them. And he went up against very powerful forces, the landowners who grew the fruits and vegetables that we put on our table. So that created a whole renaissance of consciousness, political consciousness, of culture. And I became involved in that. And all of a sudden, I felt compelled to, I felt proud of this Indian heritage. And I felt compelled to go to Mexico and to study muralism in Mexico, to study sculpture in Mexico. So I went to Mexico, and I went at first to study sculpture and muralism. I got hooked up in a bronze foundry where I was doing sculpture in bronze, and I started doing portraits of people in bronze and figurative sculpture in bronze. But I couldn't stand living in Mexico City. It was too big, too polluted, too loud, and I wanted to be in the country. So I found an Indian village outside of Mexico City called Tepoztlan. And the people there speak the language of Nahuatl, which is the same language of the Aztecs, but they weren't Aztecs. They, in fact, were overcome by the Aztecs. They were subjected to the Aztecs. And so they were considered Tepoztecos. They had undergone they had been Christianized to a certain extent, but they were still very much, their culture, their heritage was still very much alive. And in this village, they have an extensive use of masks. Now, the masks that they used were meant when the Spanish came and tried to impose their ways on the Spaniards and tried to proselytize them, Christianize them, they of course wanted to teach the gospel to the Indian people, and they saw that the Indian people used masks extensively in their rituals and their celebrations. So they had the Indian peoples carve the faces of the saints and reenact the gospel and the Passion of Christ and the birth of Christ and put on these plays. So the indigenous carvers became really good at depicting European faces. And of course, they carved the saints in the church, and they carved the altars, and they did all that work. So when the Spanish presence diminished after the colonial times, and there were no priests around, for example, then they would carve these masks and put on the masks and dress up as the Spaniards and mock the Spaniards. And the plays that they were creating became secularized and started to include humor and social satire and, you know, those kinds of things. And so there was a real element of humor in the masks and in the ceremonies. You see these Indian people dress up as Spaniards and just be so arrogant and pompous and, you know, dance around. And I became fascinated with the masks. And even though they were carved very crudely with not very good material, they were fascinating to me, even after I had seen, you know, the great works of art in Europe. And then I started to explore the museums, and I began to see ancient masks. And I began to realize that when the Spanish came and they saw the masks, masks were an essential element in indigenous ritual and ceremony. They were an element of transformation, that when the priest or whoever, the warrior, put on the mask, they would become endowed with the power of the image they put on. For example, if they put on the mask of the jaguar, then they would become endowed with the strength, the power, the courage of the jaguar. If they put on the mask of a bat, the bat represented the caves where bats come from, where water flows out of the caves. So when they put on the bat mask, they would ask for water, and they would have some contact with the metaphysical world and some power over the elements of nature. So they could call upon the water to fertilize their fields. When they put on, want to heal somebody of a certain disease, or they want to create social order through storytelling, through mythology, they would use the mask. So the masks were a very essential element. But when the Spanish came and they saw the masks had horns, you know, sometimes they probably had very fierce, very hostile looks. And of course, they probably thought that these masks represented the devil. They represented evil. Because of course, these to the Spanish people were pagans. They were doing the work of the devil, right? So they burned all the masks. Well, you know how they burned the books. We've heard the stories how they looted the libraries of the Aztecs and all the cultures, and they were full of information on history, on medicine, on spirituality, on plant life, on the animals, on insects, and they burned all of that. Well, they probably threw in all the masks and burned those too. So I began to realize what a fascinating story this was about the mask in Mexico, and how despite 500 years of oppression from the church, 500 years of geographical isolation, of economic hardship, and of course, ignorance that followed. People lost contact. The elders were killed off or died off, and they forgot what the masks were about. But they continued to carve the mask and struggle to maintain these ceremonies and rituals, even though in many cases they didn't even have relevance anymore. They were taken off the land, so they weren't an agricultural people anymore. You know what I mean? But yet, they still felt that they needed to dance in the steps of their ancestors. And I'll come back to that one phrase later. But as I was doing sculpture and doing murals and things like that, I couldn't forget about the mask, because the mask was sculpture, painting, it incorporated theater, music, dance, storytelling, spirituality. And there was so much to the mask, and it came alive. When the people put on the mask, it involved the whole community to support bringing the mask to life. It wasn't just one person doing it, but a whole community, the dancers, the musicians, the priests, whatever. And so I always felt that we had lost the use of the mask, that the mask had virtually disappeared from our lives, from our cultural lives. You know, for example, as Mexicans, as Mexican Americans, we have the food, we have the music. We had lost the Spanish language to a certain extent, but Spanish wasn't really our language anyway. Spanish is just as much our language as English is. It's a colonial language that was you know, imposed upon us. Our Indian languages were lost to a big extent. So I felt compelled to do the mask. And then in Tepoztlan, I started meeting more and more mask carvers from that area of Mexico, particularly the state of Guerrero, where the mask is still produced prolifically. And I met these mask makers who would, one day I saw a group of them, they came to sell their masks in the market. And they were just sleeping outside in a plaza underneath a little roof. So I invited them to come stay at my place. And so I befriended a lot of mask makers, and they were taken by my ability to do portraiture, to do sculpture. I had my sculptures there and my drawings, and they, wow, you're a good artist. You've been trained. See, we don't have any training, and we're just doing this to survive and try to keep this alive, try to pass it on. So they started taking me to their villages to see their mask ceremonies and their rituals. And of course, I was able to buy their masks, which was a great thing too. Not only did I give them a place to stay, but they would come and show me their masks, and I would buy the masks, and I would encourage them to buy masks, and they started encouraging me to make masks. And another fascinating thing that I found out, that the Mexicans, the ancient Mexicans, were the first culture in the world to depict human emotion in sculpture. Before the Greek, before the Romans, before anybody, ancient Mexicans were making masks and sculptures of people smiling, of people crying, of people with deformities, and you know, really, they're still finding all these wonderful examples of humanity in these ancient Mexican carvings and pottery. And I related that to what I was doing as a child, trying to capture humanity, you know, the spirit, the soul of mankind. So I started experimenting with masks. And the first masks I started carving were probably something like this. You pass this around. Kind of typical of the first masks that I did. Of course, I was fascinated with the faces of the indigenous peoples of Mexico. You know, that distinct Aztec or Maya, that the shape of the nose, the lips, the slight slant up of the eyes, that kind of Asiatic look. And so I started making my mask first out of clay, ceramic and firing them, and using them simply for decoration, as a study and for decoration. And it wasn't until later on, I'll get to that, where I started making masks out of wood. Another thing that I loved about Mexico was the old people, you know, the faces of the Indian people, and how the wrinkles and the looks on their face that were, at once they were, you could see the turmoil, the pain, the suffering was etched on their faces, you know, through the wrinkles and through the expressions. But at the same time, if you looked hard enough, you know, or if they smiled, all of a sudden you could see all the joy, you know, that they had experienced in their life. And I wanted to see if I could capture that, you know, and put that into my carvings. Another thing about Mexico was the smiling face, particularly of the people of the area of Veracruz on the eastern coast. They have these wonderful smiling faces, gorgeous carvings and pottery with these wonderful expressions of joy. And this is kind of reminiscent of that. Of course, these masks are a little bit different. I'll tell you why later, because they have a very distinct oriental feel to them. And as I started learning more about Mexican masks, I started discovering masks from other parts of the world, like from the northwest coast here, right? And from Japan, from Indonesia. And it was amazing, because I would see a mask, a stone mask, in the museums in Mexico, and then all of a sudden go to Chicago to the Field Museum and see a Northwest Coast mask that looked like it was carved by the same person. You know, it was virtually the same mask. And later on, when I went to live in Japan and studying the Japanese mask, I saw the same thing, this universal visage of humanity. That you had these different cultures, different races of people that were creating virtually the same masks. You know, you had these mask makers all over the world who were, throughout the ages, for hundreds of years, expressing mankind, humanity, and all the different levels of expression. So after I had done a collection of masks in Mexico, and I came back to the Southwest, I started experimenting with different materials. I wanted to carve wood, but I hadn't yet carved wood. I started casting my masks out of paper and making masks for theater companies and dance companies. If you don't live in the Southwest, you might not realize the fact that there's a phenomenal movement in the Southwest of folkloric dancing. It's just amazing how many dance groups, cities like Tucson, Phoenix, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, have the traditional ballet folklorico, Mexican folk dancing. And it's a wonderful way to pass on tradition and heritage, because we start with the kids real young. They get to hear the music, they hear the language, and they dance in the steps of our ancestors. So even though we're far removed from the villages in Mexico where our people might have come from, our children are still doing the dances and singing the songs. And not only does it give them pride in their heritage and in their culture, but But as Cesar Chavez said, culture is something that we share. You know, culture isn't something that we hoard and we keep in our community, but culture is an expression of our humanity. That's our gift. That's what we give to our whole community, not just our specific ethnic communities, but something that we share with the community. And by doing so, we enrich our communities, right? We give it color, we give it a voice, we give it flavor, we give it a taste, and we share what we find beautiful about humanity, and we share it. Well, one day I was went to pick up my mail, and there was a letter from the National Endowment for the Arts, and it was an application for a Japan fellowship, a fellowship to go to Japan for 1 year to do whatever you wanted to do. And the way you got this fellowship is you had to write them a letter and write them a letter saying why you deserve to go to Japan. What would your plan be to go to Japan? And what would you do in Japan? And of course, it was also based on the merit of your artwork. Well, I wanted to go to Japan because Japan makes the most sophisticated theater masks in the world.
Kabuki stuff, right?
Kabuki was a theater of the lower classes.
Okay.
But they didn't use masks; they painted their faces.
Okay.
The no theater was the ceremonial art of the samurai.
Okay.
Samurai were wealthy, very sophisticated group of people, and they employed the best carvers from throughout Asia to carve the no mask, because the no mask was sacred. It allowed the actor to put on the mask and become the deity, the demon, or the ghost that were part of the no plays. So this tradition of no theater has, they carve the mask today the same way they did 500 years ago. Nothing has changed. They do it in the same ceremonial manner with the same wood, the same tools, under the same conditions. And they truly believe that the masks are sacred. So sacred, in fact, that when you're carving the mask, and once you open the eyes of the mask, you drill open the eyes, a prayer is done, and a cleansing ceremony is done, because it's at that point that the mask has power, has the power to transform the wearer. And at that point, no one, even the person who carves the mask, is allowed to put your hand on the mask. You can only touch the mask from the corners. And at that point, the no carver puts on white cotton gloves and handles the mask very carefully to do the final carving, and then to paint the mask. And then the mask, once it's done, is very carefully put in a special silk bag and put into a special, very dark closet where the mask rests and meditates before it's used. So I had researched all this before I went and put all this information in my proposal, because I wanted to find out, I wanted to discover in Japan what no longer existed in Mexico. See, what happened in Japan, Japan closed off its border for 200 years, right? So it was because of that that the no tradition survived, and so much of their ancient history survived. And masks were used all over the world, you know, and all cultures have used masks in one way or another. But everywhere, except a few places, has it survived in its ancient form. One place being Japan, because its borders were closed off, right? The other place was Bali, Indonesia, because the Dutch didn't get there until the early 1900s, and the Balinese committed mass suicide in front of the whole world. And so therefore, the Dutch were under a lot of pressure to leave the Balinese alone. And in doing so, their culture flourish and stay pretty much the same. You have isolated villages in Mexico, some places in Peru and the Andes also isolated, and different parts of the world. But I started to realize that there were three forces that really destroyed the mask culture: Christianity, Islam, and communism. Those three forces made it difficult or impossible or against the law to use masks. You know, of course, the Christians, because it's affiliated with the devil and devil worship, whatever, paganism, Islam for the same reasons, and communism because religion, especially native religions, all religions were completely forbidden, right? So therefore the masks were oppressed and wiped out. So I went to Japan and again this mask magic happened to me again. I went to Tokyo and I received the fellowship, by the way, and I went to Tokyo and I met with my sponsors and it was the best thing in the world, because basically what you go and you check in and they get you settled and stuff like that, and they take you to the bank and give you a bank card, and they say, okay, we're going to deposit $3,500 in your account every month. See you later. You know, so you're on your own. So they set me up and I got my bank account, and then they said, well, what do you want to do? Can we help you, you know, get settled, or what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to study the no mask. And I don't know if you know anything about Japanese, but it's like, well, forget it, man. There's no way. I said, well, what do you mean there's no way? He said, well, first of all, you're not Japanese. And this no carver's society is closed even to the other Japanese. Very esoteric. You know, very closed society. You've all heard that. And they said, well, first of all, you're not Japanese. Second of all, you don't speak the language. And it's impossible. There's no way you can penetrate that particular subculture. And I said, well, this is ridiculous. I came to Japan to study the no mask. He said, well, why don't you just do your own masks and exhibit your work and that kind of thing. I said, I don't want to do my work. You know, I've already done my work. That's what got me here, doing my work. I want to study the Japanese no mask. I had studied Japan for 1 year before I went, so I had a little knowledge of the language. So they said, well, we can't help you. And they just simply refused to help me. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to go to Kyoto then, because I didn't like Tokyo. I went to Kyoto because that's the spiritual cultural center of Japan. And I didn't know what to expect. I just knew that I wanted to study the no mask. So the time that I went, it was around Christmas time. And so I had all these addresses of Americans that were living in Japan that I was going to try to track down. So when I got there, they had all left.
It's Christmas time.
Christmas time. They all went home or left, you know. So I was calling people and I couldn't find anybody. No, nobody was gone. Nobody was there. So here I was all alone. My wife and my son went to Brazil. She's from Brazil. So I was alone in Japan. It was freezing, and I'm not used to cold weather. And so I was very depressed and very upset. And the Japanese, you know, wonderful as they are very closed, especially for people of color. You know, Anglo-Americans, they love. But people of color, they shy away from. They're very, very prejudiced. So I was very depressed, very upset, and one day, and there was this number that I had for this woman who was Japanese that worked at the American Center. And I asked somebody, and they said, well, the American Center is closed. It's Christmas time. And so I had called her a few times, and nobody answered the phone. One day, out of desperation, I dialed the number, and I said, Usui-san, onegaishimasu. He said, Usui-san, this. You know, this, it was her, Usui-san. And she said, oh, it's a miracle you caught me. We're on vacation. I just walked in to get something in my office, and the phone rang. And I says, well, look, I said, I'm sorry to bother you, but I'm desperate. I came to Japan. I want to study the no mask. She goes, huh? I just met a no mask maker yesterday. As a matter of fact, he's the son of the National Living Treasure no mask carver. You know, in Japan, they have the National Living Treasures. The best artists, they give them the title of National Living Treasure, and then they give them a stipend. Because they appreciate these great artists, right? So she says, well, let's meet. Where are you? So she came down immediately to where I was, and she got on the phone. And because she was an official, right, she had an official position, and because I had an official position, I was invited by the Japanese government to be in Japan. She called him up, and she said, I would like for you to meet this artist who has this title. You know, will you take his audience? You see, otherwise, he wouldn't, you know.
Brian.
Yeah, he wouldn't say boo to me.
Yeah.
You know, because everything in Japan is introduction. It all depends who introduces you to who. So she took me to this guy's house. It was Christmas Eve. You can imagine how I missed my family. I was in a strange land. I felt so weird. It was Christmas Eve, you know. I was heartbroken for my family, right? So I go there, and here's this real arrogant, famous artist from Japan, you know. And I showed him my portfolio, and he, you know, kind of flipped through the pages and said, oh, let me show you our masks, you know. And show me these exquisite masterpieces, carvings, just the most gorgeous things I've ever seen in my life. You know, I was actually looking at, you know, real no masks, you know. And I said, he said, what are you doing in Japan? And she was translating. What are you doing in Japan? And I says, well, I want to study the no mask. Oh, that's impossible. That's impossible. That's absurd. And I said, well, what's so absurd about it? He says, well, you're not Japanese. And what do you know about the no mask, you know? Why would you want to do the no mask anyway? So I told him. And I said, I came all this way. I want to study the no mask because I want to learn about my own culture. I want to learn the ancient ways of carving. I want to make a mask that is as beautiful and sophisticated as a no mask. He says, well, do you want to be a no mask carver? I said, no. I said, I'm only here for 1 year, and I want to learn as much as I can about the no mask. And he goes, well, he says, no, you have to carve the no, you have to carve, it has to be a lifetime commitment. This isn't something that you just do for 1 year, do for fun. This is a way of life. This is what been handed down to us for generations. And he had two sons who were about my age, who he had imposed the tradition on them. They didn't really want to do it, but they were forced to carve. See what I'm saying? So he saw in me an enthusiasm that his sons didn't have, you know. So he says, he was kind of taken aback and kind of perplexed. And he says, well, why don't you just do your own masks? You know, I said, well, I don't want to do my mask. I want to do your mask. And he says, well, nobody's going to teach you the no mask in Japan. There's only one person who could teach you how to do the no mask. Only one person who's man enough to do it. And that's me. You know? And I said, well, great. And I says, he says, well, would you commit to carve 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, for the whole year? I said, yeah, that's what I'm here for. He says, well, he goes, if you're my student, you carve every day with me. I don't want you to travel. I don't want you to go out. I want you to see as much no theater as possible. And I want you to be my shadow, you know, so to speak. And I said, that's what I'm here for. So he goes, we start tomorrow. So he bought my tools, and Christmas Day, I started carving with him and his family.
Christmas doesn't mean anything in Japan. They don't have
to. Yeah, Christmas doesn't mean anything to them. So, you know, it was just another day to them. But for me, it was my best Christmas present ever, you know. So I started carving with the family's name is Nagasawa, and we started to carve masks out of wood, the massive carves out of wood. And that's where I learned how to carve in Japan. And my teacher told me, he said, look, you will not get any praise for anything you do, and everything you do will be highly scrutinized by me, by my sons, and by my father. So everything you do, everybody's going to scrutinize. So don't expect anybody to say anything nice about anything that you do. And so I got the feeling right away that they call you a gaijin. You're a foreigner, no matter what race or ethnic group. You're a foreigner. You're non-Japanese, you're a gaijin, right? Kind of like second class. And the artists in Japan are very highly esteemed. They even have to speak another form of Japanese to speak to a person of his rank. But in Japan, you don't do anything original. You make replicas of the ancient masterpieces. Nor any other artist can think that they can outdo the ancient masks. The ancient masks are sacred. They're masterpieces. So what we have to do as an artist is to create a replica of the ancient mask to the millimeter or whatever. Everything has to be exact. And everything is mapped out. All the dimensions of the lips, of the nose, of the eyes, of the distances. Everything is actually mapped out and drawn out. And there's actually... the time you're spent sharpening your tools and looking at the model of the mask. The way it works is they have a mask, an ancient mask, in their collection. And then he and his father carve a replica of the ancient mask. And that's called a mihon. The mihon you're allowed to touch. So you can't touch the ancient one. Only they can touch the mask. But you can actually touch the model, and then you have your wood, and you carve a replica of the ancient mask. But everything has to be completely symmetrical. Has to be as perfect as possible in order for the gods to feel compelled to come into the mask. Time?
Hold on a second. Yeah, you have to about 5 more or 10 minutes because... we've been asked to go to the first lunch because second lunch is
going to
be lots.
Okay, I'll finish. Okay. So anyway, that's where I learned how to carve from the Japanese, and I had to see no theater as much as possible. Well, after Japan, I went to Bali, and Bali is a whole nother mass making culture tradition, also
incredible carvers.
Great carvers
of
Bali. Incredible. So I went and I carved in Japan for 1 year and then went to Bali for another 6 months, carved with the Balinese. And then I've been back. I just got back from Bali, by the way. I've been there 5 times and I'm going to go there every summer for the rest of my life if I can. So anyway, this is kind of the state of art of my mask at this point, my wooden mask. But what I've done, I wanted to create a mask. I try to make masks that I could wear. Every time I saw these great masks, they looked like masks. They look like wood. So I wanted to create another mask that I could wear and I could transform into different characters. And with a little bit of no theater, with a little bit of Balinese theater, with a little bit of Mexican theater, with all these things I had learned, and create my own characters where I could take what I call my ministry to inner city of nonviolence social justice. So I've created a whole cast of characters. I have a performance that I do called Face to Face in a Frenzy that I take to the inner city schools and to correctional facilities or to conferences, or it can be performed anywhere under any circumstances. And I've created a mask that I call the invisible mask because it's sculpted right on my face and because it blends into my face, so I can become the character and deliver monologues that express other people's backgrounds and points of view. So I'll do a couple of characters for you. This first character is called El Vato Poeta, the poet guy.
The what?
Poet. He's a poet. Hey, what's up, everybody? Hijo de man, it's good to be here today, say.
Simón, que sí, híjole, man, I love to come to Holland Village, man, because I love to hang out with all the people, and I love to go to the worship services, and I love to go to camping. Híjole, it's fun over here, man. You know, hey, man, I come from the inner city, and say, híjole, man, I tell you, man, when I grew up, man, I had it rough, I had it rough, man. When I was coming up, man, all my homeboys were dropping out of school. They were getting guns, they were getting into drugs, they were getting into gangs. They used to think they were all bad. And they used to put a lot of pressure on me, eh? They used to tell me, orderly homeboy, drop out of school. You don't need that crap, man. And you know, I started to think about it, man. You know, yeah, I wanted to get a job and help out my familia, you know. But you know what? Hey, man, I may be crazy. Hey, man, but I ain't stupid. No, man, for real. So I decided a long time ago, man, I got a responsibility to my community, a responsibility to my family, and a responsibility to myself, eh? Yeah, man, so I stayed in school. I got an education. And check this one out. It's like, hey, man, I graduated from college, man. For real, this is, who would have thought me? An all-American, redneck, Mexican homeboy? Graduating from college, eh? Hey, I'm gonna stop there either, man. So I was kidding, man. Hey, man, I wanna run for president. Hey, man, for real, man. Hey, man, this is America, man. Think about it. Me, an all-American, redneck, Mexican homeboy, as commander-in-chief. Ooh, ooh, I like that, man. Especially the chief. Man, I could be the Geronimo of my generation. I could keep Cesar Chavez's legacy alive by being a messiah for the migrant, the malnourished, the misfortunate, and the misled. I could be a missionary to mainstream America who maintain their lavish lifestyles, languishing in the lap of luxury, safe inside their segregated sanctuaries, praying for their own salvation, committing the same sins their savior sacrificed his life to forgive. So remember, now when the time comes, vote for me, El Vato Poeta, your multicultural connection with the cosmic connotation.
So I have all kinds of characters. These are just two. Here's another one. This is the Rastaman.
John Bon, peace, brother, one love, all right, yeah. Hey, you know what? Last night, I had a dream. John Bon, I had a dream that there was peace spread throughout the land, that all the bitter enemies had come to understand that hatred, wow, it's an evil team destined to destroy. The differences between us is something to enjoy. John, mom, peace, brother, one love, all right, yes!
So, that's where I'm at right now with my mask making is creating, I call it the invisible mask, because I want the mask to disappear on the face. And because I make it on the face, it fits perfect. It's not uncomfortable. I don't even feel the weight of the mask. Weight is not even an issue because it conforms to the bone structure. And it also gives me a special effect. When dealing with kids, you know, who watch movies and music videos, and they have all these special effects, I have to freak them out. I have to get their attention and capture it. So the mask gives me that power. It gives me that visual magic, if you will, over my audiences to captivate them. And by changing the mask constantly, changing the character, the voice, the movement, the monologues, the poetry, it captivates my audience so that I get their attention. I can deliver these monologues. And as you can see, you just got a snippet of it, but get these positive messages to young and old alike, but especially kids, because they don't have, you know, the attention span is so small. Sure. Any questions?
What's the jewelry you have there?
This is also the latest thing I'm doing here. I'm making some jewelry. I carved these masks out of wood. and make jewelry to sell. This is a like an ebony black wood, and then I use the scraps from the mahogany, and I carve a smaller masks. So I have those available. All of these masks, and these I bring along to sell for people that might want to purchase a mask or a piece of jewelry. So you guys can come and look at them if you want. But I guess we're out of time.